As a listener of DNA Today, you've probably heard me talk about NIPT, non-invasive prenatal testing, that looks for extra or missing chromosome conditions during pregnancy. But did you know there's also a test that can screen for recessive disorders like cystic fibrosis and fetal antigens? Billion to One offers Unity Screen, which does all of this from one blood draw from a pregnant person. Visit unityscreen.com for more information and check out our DNA Today episodes where Billion to One experts joined me to explore non-invasive prenatal screening for recessive conditions. That was episode 224. And red blood cell fetal antigens. That was episode 225. Surely you've heard of whole genome sequencing, but what about rapid and ultra-rapid whole genome sequencing? This is an emerging method of diagnosing genetic conditions for quick management. PerkinElmer Genomics offers this incredibly valuable test, which can be life-saving for ill babies and kids. Learn more in our full episode with PerkinElmer Genomics on here, DNA Today. You can visit PerkinElmerGenomics.com for more information. The link is also available in the show notes and on our website, DNAtoday.com.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you. We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research. For over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science in Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. Hi, my guest today is Divya Ramachandra, who is a genetic counselor and program coordinator in Chicago, practicing primarily in prenatal, pediatric, and inpatient genetics. She presented at the National Society of Genetic Counselors annual conference this past fall, titled From Lethal to Life-Limiting Paradigm Shift in Caring for Patients with Trisomy 13 or 18, and we referenced this in our recap episode of the conference. That was episode 212, and fellow genetic counselor and actually our graphic designer, that's how we got our snazzy logo, Ashlyn Enochian and I shared how surprised we were at everything we learned. So we're just so excited to now have you on the show because I have so many questions for you. And again, we're going to be talking about Trisomy 13 and Trisomy 18. And for background, for people that maybe haven't listened to a lot of episodes of DNA Today, I'm a prenatal genetic counselor. So I've been doing that for about 2.5 years. And even I was surprised by a lot of the information. I don't want to say all, but maybe all of the information that was presented. It was one of the best sessions that I attended at NSGC. So Divya, thank you so much for coming on. And you're going to share so much knowledge that I'm going to learn from and I know my audience is going to learn from.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me and giving me this opportunity. I'm really excited.
So let's start with, you know, kind of a quick overview of Trisomy 13 and Trisomy 18, because most people listening are going to know these disorders. But for those that maybe are students or aren't as privy to this information, could you give us your elevator pitch of just kind of that overall synopsis of what the disorders are?
Yeah, so trisomy 18 and 13 are chromosome abnormalities. They involve typically an whole extra chromosome of number 13 and number 18. And majority of cases are not inherited. So, you know, there's usually not a family history. And it's something that we, you know, routinely screen for in the prenatal period.
And most people nowadays are, when they're pregnant, offered the screenings that, you know, you're referring to in terms of ultrasound screenings, definitely. We've been doing that for how many decades? But also the genetic screening through blood work. So speaking of the ultrasound, what are often signs that can come up on ultrasound that can make healthcare providers suspicious for trisomy 13 and trisomy 18?
Yeah, so trisomy 13 and 18 are two separate conditions, but at the same time have a lot of overlapping features. So you know, on ultrasound, I think you can see anywhere from one or two markers to multiple, especially when I see IUGR, intrauterine growth restriction, that especially early on in a pregnancy, that's a significant sign that we need to be considering a trisomy, specifically of 18 and 13. We can also see children have heart defects, the classic clenched fists, club feet, or rocker bottom feet, midline defects like a cleft palate, omphalocele, brain abnormalities. So you can see literally everything under the sun with trisomy 18 and 13. But I also say, as a prenatal counselor, I have seen cases that have shocked me where it was just isolated IUGR. I have a trisomy 13 case where there was only a two vessel cord found. So it can range anywhere from multiple abnormalities to just a few indications, which is why it's always important to make sure patients are offered aneuploidy screening, even if the ultrasound have soft markers.
Yeah, and that's an important term that you mentioned, soft markers, something like increased nuchal translucency. I think you mentioned that, but when there's extra fluid at the back of the neck, more than we would expect to see. So above 3.0, above 3.5, oftentimes cases that I'm thinking of, you know, it's been like 4 or 5 or sometimes even more, depending, especially for other conditions like Turner syndrome, that tends to be even higher. So as you said, it really ranges, like so many genetic disorders that we talk about on this show. And as you mentioned, the blood test, non-invasive prenatal screening, also screens for extra or missing chromosome conditions. And it really started with Down syndrome, followed by trisomy 13 and 18. So how accurate are these blood tests? And why does the pregnant person's age of delivery affect the accuracy of the results? Or their, if I get technical for a second, positive predictive value?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I just did grand rounds on this, actually.
Perfect timing.
I like to use the word detection rate when I talk about this, because the word accuracy makes it seem like we're saying, oh, it's 99% accurate, things like that. And that's often what you'll see advertised. Really, what we're talking about is, you know, what's the detection rate for these conditions? And then if they come back high risk, what is the chance that this is true? Like, as you said, positive predictive value. And every company has a different way of, you know, different detection rates, different PPVs or positive predictive values. The highest is for Down syndrome. And after that, it gets lower for trisomy 18 and 13. And this is based, both the positive predictive value and the detection rate are based on the incidence. So Down syndrome is one of the most common conditions. That's why, in general, it has a higher detection rate, and trisomy 18, second most common, trisomy 13, third most common. Now, the age at delivery is important when in relation to the positive predictive value, because essentially what these companies use is, okay, what is the incidence of this condition? So how common is it? And also how common is it at this maternal age? For extra chromosomes outside of the sex chromosomes, we see there's a higher risk of it as we get older. And the risk increases a little bit. You know, I think a lot of people walk in at 38 and think it's going to be like a 50% chance, and it's really not. But we do know in general, the chances of a woman at 39 having a baby with a chromosome abnormality is much higher than somebody who's 23. And so that's why you can see different positive predictive values in women when they get a high risk result.
And it's important to mention too, on top of all of that, if someone has frozen their eggs, let's say at 30, and then they're implanting that egg at 40 and then having a pregnancy, we're not considering that egg to be like, oh, they're going to be 40 at delivery. We're realizing, okay, it was frozen at 30. So kind of frozen in time when we think about it that way. But for people that are naturally conceiving, so for, you know, a good chunk of our patients, that is certainly the case. So now, stepping outside of just the background information, I really want to hear more from you in terms of your expertise with this condition and your counseling expertise. So from a counseling perspective, what advice do you have for healthcare providers and genetic counselors on how to approach conversations with people who have a pregnancy that has a high chance for having trisomy 13 or 18? So in those very beginning stages where maybe you have the non-invasive prenatal screening blood test come back where there's that, you know, high chance, or we're seeing a lot of markers on ultrasound, or where there's, you know, it's very high suspicion for this. What are some options that should be reviewed? What is your really approach when it comes to counseling for those first conversations?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think my counseling has significantly changed based on my pediatric research in terms of looking into literature. So if you're okay with it, I thought maybe I would start off a little bit with that and talk about how that's changed my way of prenatal counseling.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, so, you know, we're all taught in school that trisomy 18 and 13 are lethal, that, you know, children don't survive. This general number of 10% survive to 1 year old. I work at a hospital that is known for pediatric cardiac surgery. So we actually see, because about 80 to 90% of trisomy 18 and 13 patients will have a heart defect. So we see a lot of patients, a lot more than the average center with trisomy 18 and 13. And many times these are families who chose to continue a pregnancy. So their outlook is very different. And I was confronted with these parents telling me, you know, do you actually know what the current research is? And then also all of this back and forth debate within our medical teams about whether we offer intervention. And so, you know, the findings, which I can go into details more further through, is children with trisomy 18 and 13, certain children do significantly benefit from interventions, and that can significantly change their prognosis in terms of how long they're living. And so the fact that there's research showing that there are children who are living into their teenage years, some that are even like 20 plus years old, and enough of them where you have multiple papers showing this, immediately tells me that this is no longer a lethal condition, and that the term lethal isn't one that I should be using or anyone should be using even prenatally.
So now I see this. Which is a huge shift from what we've learned in school, as you started saying, and that was like the title of the NSGC talk, from lethal to life-limiting, that we should be adjusting the language we're using around this. And when I heard that, I was like, wow, that's a really good point. Like, I didn't know about all of the statistics, and the general population of genetic counselors, I don't think, knows what you're sharing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think we've just had this ingrained in our head that it's lethal, and we don't really look past that. And in general, it's still a rare condition and rare for people to continue a pregnancy. So that long-term outlook, you're not always going to see in a general genetics clinic. And so my advice with prenatal genetic counselors and prenatal providers is that, first of all, you approach any type of screen, any type of blood test, as reminding them that this is a screen. I have seen many false positives for trisomy 18 and 13. The positive predictive value for trisomy 13 is much lower than trisomy 18 and Down syndrome. So the first conversation, you know, is, how would you like to confirm these results? But in general, when I approach the conversation, I say, I'm honest with them. I say, this is a very severe condition if it's present. And not everyone is the same. In general, we know these pregnancies are at a high risk of passing away before birth. We know that they're a high risk of passing away after birth. We know that all of these children will have some level of medical complications, again, differing. I never use the word lethal. I say we know this can be a life-limiting condition, that in many cases, these children, you know, may not make it past childhood. And something that has changed in my counseling is I tell them we take it by steps. You know, we talk about the prenatal period. Okay, when you've made it through the prenatal period, what does delivery look like? When you've made it through delivery, what does the NICU and then long-term care look like? And these percentages change the likelihoods of certain, you know, outcomes change as you go through a pregnancy. And I think we forget that once patients make the decision to continue a pregnancy, it's more than just like, well, we'll see what happens after delivery. You know, it's really based on the family, what their motivations are. Do they want monitoring in the third trimester? If they saw the, you know, baby in distress, would they go for a C-section? Like, you know, all of those things, I think it's really important to talk about with families. And then I think prenatal counselors can incorporate the pediatric research. You know, if you see a pregnancy where there's a brain abnormality, a heart defect, like multiple things going on, those are more severe cases. Even outside of there being a chromosome abnormality, we're concerned. Versus you see isolated IUGR or intrauterine growth restriction. Well, then we still say it's a serious condition. There's a lot of things we can't see on an ultrasound or predict. But I change my counseling a little bit. I say, you know, this may be a case where you're looking at a potential for baby to live after birth. And so we need to have more of a conversation of what living looks like, because some of these families just think baby's going to die right away and they aren't prepared for anything more than that.
Genetic technology moves fast. The first genome took 13 years to finish a draft. For reference, this was 20 years ago in 2003. And now a whole genome sequence can be performed in days, even hours. Since sequencing an entire genome can be done in such a short amount of time, this lowers the cost, which means more people can utilize whole genome sequencing now. This is particularly helpful in the NICU for ill infants. PerkinElmer Genomics explained more to me in our full episode here on DNA Today. It is remarkable how quick diagnosis from whole genome sequencing can save a baby's life with a change in treatment informed from the results of that test. I learned more about how genome data is mined to maximize useful information from one data set and other omic assays that help enhance diagnosis. Don't miss the full episode here on DNA Today. You can visit PerkinElmerGenomics.com for more information. The link is also available in the show notes and on our website, DNAtoday.com. Non-invasive prenatal testing, screening, has been around for a decade now, as long as DNA Today, actually. And the technology has evolved in those 10 years. The screening started to detect Down syndrome, and now Billion-to-One's Unity screen assesses for the chance for pregnancies to have aneuploidies, which are extra missing chromosome conditions, recessive conditions like cystic fibrosis and sickle cell, and the presence of red blood cell fetal antigens. Billion-to-One named the screening Unity Screen as it brings together fetal screening for aneuploidies and recessive conditions. It also represents uniting pregnant patients in more equitable care. Unity does not require a blood sample from the other biological parent or sperm donor to assess fetal risk, enabling more pregnancies at risk to be affected with recessive conditions to be identified earlier in pregnancy as compared to traditional carrier screening. Billion-to-One is working towards one goal: to detect disease one molecule at a time. Know early with one simple blood test. Visit unityscreen.com for more information. And be sure to check out our DNA Today episodes, where Billion-to-One experts join me to explore non-invasive prenatal screening for recessive conditions. That's episode 224. And red blood cell fetal antigens. That's episode 225. And you're doing such a good job as you're explaining this of highlighting how valuable it is to focus on parental autonomy. And that you as the counselor want to understand, well, what are your goals? Like, you want to continue this pregnancy, okay, and going through, like, well, let's get deeper into that then. As you said, like, do you want to do monitoring when you're in the third trimester? Do you not? Like, some of those that it's not necessarily like other areas of healthcare where it's like, oh, this is your diagnosis, this is your treatment, you got to come for these appointments. Genetic counseling has always been different in that way, where we are saying, here's the roadmap, where do you want to go with it? Let me help you in that journey and educate you along the way. And one, you know, aspect and term I came across while prepping for this, and I think listening to your talk at NSGC, is moral distress, and just how important this is to educate people and talk about this. Could you educate our listeners what moral distress is and how you're able to process this with patients? Because I think it fits in with what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, so I mean, there's, you know, moral distress for patients and families, and then a lot of moral distress within the staff, and those two are separate things that we confront. I mean, in general, moral distress is defined as, you know, when somebody thinks ethically they know the correct action, but they aren't able to take it, or there's constraints in taking it. So I would say moral distress is probably more for providers, but you see it in patients when, for example, I have patients where their religion is very pro-choice or pro-life, where termination is not accepted, where previously they were, you know, anti-abortion, but now they're faced with this, and now it's real and it's personal to them, and they have this, like, I know what I'm supposed to do based on my upbringing and background, but I don't know if I can do it. Like, I don't know if I can do this. That moral distress is real, and patients need a supportive environment. And something I've learned from working with palliative care, both prenatally and pediatrically, is that patients' goals change. You know, I think a lot of times we feel like, oh, we give the diagnosis, we talk with them, and then we send them to maternal fetal medicine, and that's it. But I think there's a lot of value in genetic counselors following up, revisiting goals, see where the families are, they've processed information, they've talked, and not assuming when a patient says they want one path that they'll definitely stick with it.
I've seen that with my patients of, you know, oftentimes they'll flip multiple times just as they're processing the information and trying it on, like, well, what if I did this? What if I didn't do that? And so they're, you know, on both sides. And I try to start conversations saying, like, last time we talked about this, like, you know, have your thoughts changed since then? Is that still what you're thinking? To be able to check in with that.
Yeah.
Because that's a really important point.
Yeah. And I think something really important is acknowledging moral distress amongst the staff, both prenatally and pediatrically. Because I'll admit, when I came into looking at this and researching it, that I have my own personal view. And it's often very different from what patients choose, especially in the pediatric environment. And it's really hard when we think, you know, some LC providers say, you know, I don't want the child to suffer, right? And it's such an subjective idea of what quality of life is. I mean, I talk about that all of the time, that really it is a subjective concept. And so I tell providers all the time, I want to start off by saying it is okay that you feel torn. It is okay that you have different ideas. You're a human being. And I had a cardiologist tell me once, he said, at the end of the day, I want to know that I'm doing something good, something that's beneficial to my patients. And that humanizes it. It's not just that maybe we have a different idea of quality of life. We have to remember that healthcare professionals come into this role because they want to do good. So what happens when your idea of quality of life clashes with the families? And instead of doing, you know, like an overall, well, it's the parent's choice, the family's choice, you need to respect that. I mean, you do. I think it's always important to allow for discussion in a environment where staff can express themselves and work through their feelings, because otherwise it makes it just, it's just so hard for everyone involved.
Yeah, we need to be able to support each other as healthcare providers and team members, so that you're not having these thoughts just in your head and you're able to express them with your coworkers and saying, like, you know, I'm having a tough time with this case because I see where they're coming from, but I know I'd make a different choice. And that's really, it's a battle within me and I want to support them, but it's just, it's been tough, you know, ethically, just thinking about the different aspects there. And, you know, as you've been talking about during these counseling sessions and conversations, you're talking a lot about, you know, the parental autonomy and the goals and checking in with that. What is the type of decision making that you're helping people with? You know, we talked about the beginning of, okay, do you want to confirm this result with like an amniocentesis or CVS? If someone decides that they are continuing the pregnancy and say we've confirmed it through an amnio, what are those next steps in terms of other decision making. I'm thinking of different delivery plans, feeding options, things along those lines.
Yeah. So, you know, prenatally, we talk about the biggest thing is, do you want to monitor? You know, do you want to monitor for fetal distress? And if fetal distress occurs, do you want us to intervene with like a C-section, something like that? And then, you know, a lot of my focus on this topic has been pediatrics. And so what we talk about is in the delivery room, do you want CPR? Do you want a child to be intubated? These can be very striking interventions when a family sees it. Some families, the reason they're continuing the pregnancy is they said, I just want nature to take its course. I want to leave it up to a higher power. I don't want to intervene. And so they may not choose to do intubation or CPR. I talk with families. I first ask them, and this is good for prenatal and pediatric counseling, what is your definition of quality of life? What kind of future, when I tell you about some of these things, what kind of future are you envisioning as a good quality or acceptable quality of life for you? And some families will tell me, well, I don't want them to stay in the hospital for a long time. I don't want them to be hooked up on ventilators. You know, my goal is to take them home. And so what we direct them or more heavily talk about is going to change. You know, if their goal is to go home, you know, maybe we don't do full cardiac surgery that takes multiple steps, right? Maybe we do what we call palliative surgery that at least gives them the stability to be discharged from the hospital and go home with family. And that's one of the key things about the pediatric research, and most of the research on interventions with trisomy 18 and 13 are around cardiac surgery. And even the different motivations behind cardiac surgery. I was blown away by some of the comments in these discussion sections of these papers, noting that, you know, sometimes the family's goal is to take their child home. And so cardiac surgery may not be to elongate a child's life for as long as they can, but to achieve a family's goal of taking their child home to meet their family and maybe, you know, having that time versus the risk of baby passing away in the hospital. I thought that was something really important when we talk about goals is there's different motivations behind these interventions.
And these are making really big decisions in terms of like if a baby's going to have heart surgery, like you need to have these conversations ahead mm-hmm. of time, because these are, you know, especially in the moment decision making, like are we doing CPR in baby, you know, at delivery?
Right.
That's not something that you're going to be suddenly talking about while it's happening. You have to have that set up ahead of time. And as we've been talking about, the prognosis have really changed, you know, with people with these conditions. And I mentioned on our NSGC recap episode, episode 212, the link is in the show notes for people that want to listen back, that I was shocked, and I'm still shocked months later, that of non-mosaic trisomy mm-hmm. 18 and 13 patients that survived two hospital discharge, so kind of these babies that we're talking about now, the median age of survival is 14.8 years. Mm-hmm. And I was like, when I forget who exactly presented, was that you that presented that one?
Yeah.
So, I mean, everybody was like shocked in the room. There was a good amount of people in there. I'm not good at estimating, but I don't know, 50, 70 people, something like that. Everybody was shocked. I mean, the mm-hmm. number has stuck with me, and I have to highlight, it's non-mosaic. Because at first I was like, oh, okay, well, it's probably people that not all of their cells have this extra chromosome, right. But you made sure it was specifically, no, this is full. So how has it changed in terms of the pediatric literature that we're talking about? We'll certainly link to things in the show notes, but anything you wanted to just mention on the air?
Yeah, so that study that, you know, I quoted from, so this was a study done or a paper done back in 2017 that was looking at cases over a span of like 20 years in this United States Pediatric Cardiac Care Consortium, where they have all this data. And they were looking at the long-term outcomes of children who did receive interventions, which it was, you know, literature from 1982 to 2008, they were dealing with a small group of people even back then. And they were looking at two things. They were looking at the in-hospital mortality for children with trisomy 18 and 13, and then looking, you know, after discharge, what the long-term survival was. And I mean, when I saw this paper, I had to read it multiple times. I read it again before I did the NSGC presentation to make sure I, you know, knew my facts and I was speaking correctly. But like you said, they found that the median survival for non-mosaic trisomy 18 and 13 patients was 14.5 years.
And 0.5. All right. I was a little off there.
Yeah, yes. Just a little. 14.5 years. And I mean, the fact that they have data even at 10 years, right, it was like shocking to me. Like, that's what pushed me to look into it more. And I'll acknowledge that we're dealing with a small N, like a small number of patients we're looking at. But still, I mean, it goes back to, you know, why are we talking about lethality? And what was also interesting is that, you know, another assumption is that, oh, you know, children who have cardiac surgery with this condition they're probably going to pass away, right, during the surgery. So it's more harmful than not. But this same study found that the in-hospital mortality rate for patients with trisomy 18 who had surgery was 13%, and for trisomy 13 was 27.6%. And I'll acknowledge that is much higher than children who have cardiac surgery without trisomy 18 and 13. So it's not like, oh, you know, we can cite the same statistics. But I think it's much lower than I at least imagined it would be. And they, in that study, they said for the children who did not receive that cardiac surgery, the in-hospital mortality was 75%. So there's a big difference. Another thing I emphasize to everyone is that these are not all patients. These are very specific patients with trisomy 18 and 13. And there was a really great article that came out recently highlighting some of these factors that influence the prognosis rate, helping providers use it as a guideline when they are talking in cath conference and making these decisions. So I emphasize to everybody, patients and providers, we're not making a blanket statement that all children with trisomy 18 and 13 benefit from surgery. This is not a Down syndrome scenario. This is very different. We're saying that you can't stop reading at trisomy 18 and 13 in the medical chart. We really need to be looking at these children holistically, including their family's goals and then their clinical presentation. And based on that, making decisions about who is a good candidate for surgery and who's not.
Yeah, I think that's very well said, and that we do need to be reading all this literature that you've done such a good job of researching and reading over and over some of the same papers to really have it sink in and have you remember. Because, you know, when I'm talking to a patient that has that high chance, or we do have a diagnosis, like, they're asking me all these questions. I need to know the information, and every other prenatal genetic counselor or healthcare provider out there, MFMs, OBGYNs, nurses, nurse practitioners. There's so many people that should be aware of this, not just genetic counselors. But I just wanted to close out. I wish we had more time because I mean, this is just, I'm learning so much. But I wanted to close out with just resources. And if there's any postnatal care conferences, I can see that being a match for some of this information of where you want to lead people. And we'll certainly link to things in the show notes as well as the paper that you've been talking about.
Yeah. And one of the papers that I would highlight that I talked about as being a guideline is called Cardiac Surgery and Trisomy 18 and 13, A Guide to Clinical Decision Making. And I think my biggest recommendation is that, and they have done, again, a number of studies on this, is that there is communication between the prenatal and the pediatric team, and that there is an opportunity for the parents before they deliver to be in the same room as all of those providers. You know, if there is a patient with a cardiac defect, well, let's talk about what decisions we make for cardiac surgery. You know, for example, a patient who's on a ventilator for multiple days, they have a lower chance of surviving with the cardiac surgery and past surgery. So those are things, though, we can't tell from an ultrasound. So that's important to tell the parents. You know, we don't know necessarily how baby's going to do breathing, but these are some of the things that we take into consideration when we talk about cardiac surgery. And you should know that the mortality is higher, but it's not, you know, 100%. So I think a combined prenatal and postnatal care conference is super important, and that communication between both the teams so that there's a handoff, including between a prenatal and pediatric genetic counselors. I think there should be that communication of like, hey, this is the family, this is their goals, this is what's been going on, that the prenatal counselor can provide to the pediatric genetics team. And then there are these surprise pediatric diagnoses where there was no testing prenatally. And in that circumstance, my recommendation is that the medical staff works as a team, a cohesive team. They have conferences with each other before they walk in with the family, and that they take into consideration the family's goals just as much as the clinical decision. So I think the communication and interdisciplinary work is the most important part of applying all of this.
And for parents, patient advocates listening, I think that's really great to ask for. If that's not already in the works, to say like, I would like to meet with, you know, people from my prenatal team and my postnatal team together, or like, you know, I, as a healthcare provider, that's something that I'd be like, yes, let me do, if I wasn't already planning on doing that. So I think, you know, be that, you know, quote unquote, annoying patient and ask for what you need. I'm a big fan of that. You know, when patients are like, I'm sorry to be annoying, but I'm like, no, you're doing your job. Like, please ask me for things, right? So I think that's just fantastic. But Divya, thank you so much for coming on and just sharing so much of this. Unfortunately, the on-demand isn't available anymore, but hopefully we're hearing even more from you at other NSGC events, and that people have learned a lot from this episode and the papers that we're linking to at dnatoday.com. Thank you again so much for just sharing all of that and really putting a light on this, where I don't see conversations being had about this. So I really appreciate you, you know, taking this on and, you know, getting on a soapbox and talking about all this.
Yeah, thank you so much for that opportunity, and feel free to include my information if anybody is interested in reaching out.
Awesome. Yeah, you guys can email info@dnatoday.com, and then I'll forward them on. So. For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, are all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.